Words don't just describe reality, they create it. Every metaphor, every label, every repeated phrase leaves an imprint. They frame how we see others before we ever meet them. And when enough people share the same language, it becomes the lens through which an entire society decides who belongs and who doesn't. That's the power of words, not simply to reflect, but to reshape. When you call someone a rat, you invite extermination. When you call them a parasite, you invite cleansing. When you call them a disease, you invite a cure. Notice how each metaphor smuggles in an action, a script for what comes next. The language is not neutral. It carries violence inside it, tucked beneath the surface of the comparison. Think of how easy it is to say, "They're animals." It sounds simple, even childish, but animals can be caged, trained, beaten, slaughtered. No one holds a funeral for a cockroach, and that's the point. By changing the category of what someone is, you change the range of what can be done to them. This is why dehumanizing language spreads so quickly. It's efficient. It condenses fear, disgust, and justification into one single phrase. It removes the need for argument. You don't have to prove anything once the metaphor has done the work for you. It bypasses debate and lands directly in the gut. History is saturated with these phrases: cockroaches, Untermenschen, savages, primitives. Each word cleared the path for brutality. Each word framed violence as necessary, even righteous. And once the words were spoken often enough, people no longer heard them as metaphors. They heard them as truth. But this isn't just history. Listen closely to the present. Migrants described as floods or waves. Communities called infestations. Opponents painted as cancers that must be cut out. The metaphors may shift, but the logic remains the same. If they are less than human, then any response becomes acceptable. We underestimate how sticky language can be. A phrase enters public debate and soon shows up in headlines, talk shows, conversations at work. It takes on a life of its own, bouncing from mouth to mouth to mouth, until no one remembers where it began. By then, it doesn't feel like rhetoric anymore. It feels like reality. And if it feels real, it shapes what people are willing to do. That's why authoritarian movements always begin with language. They don't start by rounding people up. They start by renaming them. They plant metaphors that grow into weapons. And once the soil of public discourse has been seeded, the harvest of violence is only a matter of time. You might think, but they're just words. It's tempting to believe that words are harmless, that what matters is action. But actions are built on stories, and stories are built from words. Before the hand strikes, the mind must be convinced, and language is the tool that does the convincing. Even jokes carry this power. A slur wrapped in laughter doesn't disappear. It lingers. It makes cruelty palatable. It makes the audience complicit. And once people laugh together, they're less likely to challenge the sentiment beneath the humor. The word has already done its work, disguised as entertainment. This is why dehumanizing speech is never innocent. Even when it's casual, even when it's careless, even when it's said without intent to harm, the metaphor outlives the speaker. It spreads, it multiplies, it influences others who hear it. Words travel further than we do, carrying their shadows into rooms we'll never enter. And once language has reshaped perception, violence becomes easier to justify. You don't have to see yourself as cruel. You only have to believe the metaphor. If someone is a parasite, then removing them is actually medicine. If someone is an animal, then controlling them is order. The words carry the moral logic, relieving you of the burden of doubt. Think about how we talk about crime. Thugs, animals, super predators. Each term doesn't just describe, it prescribes. It nudges society toward harsher laws, harsher policing, harsher sentences. And once those laws are in place, the language seems justified, when in fact the language was the cause. This cycle is self-reinforcing. Language shapes policy. Policy shapes perception. Perception shapes more language. Round and round it goes until the line between metaphor and reality disappears. By the end, the word and the act are indistinguishable, and the violence feels inevitable, even natural. So when we say language is a weapon, we mean it literally. Not a weapon that kills in a single strike, but one that prepares the ground. It softens resistance. It dulls empathy. It primes the imagination for cruelty. And once enough imaginations have been primed, action follows. Because violence doesn't start with a bullet. It starts with a word. It is tempting to imagine that language is only dangerous when shouted loudly, when plastered on posters, or broadcast from podiums. But often the most corrosive phrases are the quietest ones. A bureaucratic term in a policy document. A clinical phrase in a medical report. A headline trimmed to fit a column. Each one seems harmless in isolation, yet together they create a climate where cruelty feels like administration and exclusion feels like procedure. This is why words like collateral damage are so chilling. They erase the image of bodies, families, entire lives, and replace them with an abstract category. Suddenly, grief is measured in statistics. Responsibility is softened by euphemism. And those who caused the harm can tell themselves they never harmed anyone at all. Language is the great anesthetic. It numbs us to what we would otherwise find unbearable. It turns screams into numbers, loss into percentages, injustice into policy outcomes. And once we are numb, we stop asking the questions that matter. We stop seeing the people hidden behind the words. That numbness is not accidental. It is engineered. But dehumanizing language doesn't only exist in governments or armies. It lives in everyday spaces. Think of workplaces where people are called resources instead of names. Think of schools where students are reduced to test scores. Think of online spaces where strangers are reduced to usernames, avatars, stereotypes. In each case, the person disappears behind the word, and what's left can be managed, ignored, or discarded. We tell ourselves that words can't hurt us, but that old saying, "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me," is absolutely not true. Words shape the blows that are later thrown. They provide the script that violence follows. They make it possible to harm without hesitation, to strike without guilt. Words are not the opposite of violence. They are its rehearsal. Once we understand this, we begin to hear differently. We notice how quickly metaphors spread, how eagerly they are repeated in times of crisis, how phrases like "enemy of the people" or "traitor" don't just name an opponent, but mark them as outside the circle of belonging. And once someone is outside the circle, what happens to them no longer feels like our concern. This is why propaganda always begins with words, not with tanks, not with prisons, but with a story that divides the world into pure and impure, us and them, human and less than. The weapons come later. The words prepare the battlefield. But here's the unsettling truth. We all use language this way, even if not for violence. We talk about people as obstacles when they slow us down. We call someone toxic when we don't want to deal with their pain. We frame colleagues as dead weight when they're struggling. These phrases may not lead to war, but they still reduce a person to one single function, stripping away their complexity. Dehumanization is not only a political act, it is a personal habit. And habits spread. The way you describe someone influences the way others see them. Dismiss someone often enough, and they will be dismissed by others without question. Praise someone as brilliant, and their mistakes will be forgiven. Language doesn't just reflect reputation, it creates it. That's why controlling the story is often more powerful than controlling the action. If words can wound, they can also protect. That is the other side of this truth. Calling someone by name restores their individuality. Telling their story restores their humanity. Describing their suffering in detail resists the flattening power of euphemism. Language can be a weapon, but it can also be a shield. It depends on how we choose to use it. This is where responsibility begins. We cannot control every headline or every speech, but we can control our own tongues. We can decide whether to pass along the joke, whether to repeat the stereotype, whether to let the euphemism stand unchallenged. Each choice is small, but small choices accumulate. They either build walls between us or tear them down. When you refuse dehumanizing language, you do more than protect yourself. You disrupt the cycle. You make others pause, if only for a moment. You break the rhythm of repetition that gives such words their strength. Resistance begins with noticing, but it takes courage to act on that noticing. Courage to say, "That's not funny." Or courage to insist on the harder truth when the easier lie is more popular. And yet, this courage is often quiet. It doesn't look like protest in the streets. It looks like a conversation interrupted, a headline questioned, a phrase rephrased. It looks like choosing to see the person in front of you when the culture around you insists on seeing only the category. Small acts of language may not seem like much, but they keep empathy alive. Because once empathy is gone, words lose their power to protect. They become only weapons, tools of division and harm. The fight over language is not trivial. It is the fight over the boundaries of humanity itself. Every phrase, every metaphor, every story is a battle line. And when we surrender those lines, we surrender people. So listen carefully to the words around you. Not just the loud ones, but the quiet ones. Not just the insults, but the euphemisms. Not just the slogans, but the everyday metaphors we repeat without thought. Because language is not decoration. It is foundation. It builds the world we live in. And the world it builds depends on the words we allow to take root.